Welcome back to the KingCast, y'all. Appropriately enough, this week's sponsor is the new film, The Monkey. You might have heard of it. Based on Stephen King's iconic short story, The Monkey has been brought to the screen by Osgood Perkins, the writer-director of Longlegs, and horror master James Wan. Stephen King himself has described The Monkey as, quote, batshit insane, and said, you've never seen anything like it, and Bloody Disgusting calls it the most outrageous horror movie of the year. The Monkey opens up in theaters everywhere on February 21st, and you just may be hearing a little bit more about the movie in the coming weeks. Who's to say? And since we've been on a hiatus, you know, I gotta kind of warm up the vocal cords, get a little bit ready for this one. Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. This magazine, it's not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible and delivered right to your door 4 times a year. Each issue is filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including little old me from time to time. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, so if you want to join in on the fun, and you damn well should, you're going to need to subscribe. And in order to do that, all you got to do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up. And guess what, kiddies? Because you are KingCast listeners and you are in the Fangoria family, I have a nice discount code to give you that will save you a gigantic 25% off of your subscription. So go to Fangoria.com, use code KingCast at checkout to save 25% off of your order. Now on with the show.
Hi, my name is Stephen King.
The ice is gonna break!
Body's gonna go see a dead body.
Well, sometimes that is better.
Hello and welcome back to the KingCast. I'm Eric Vespi.
And I'm Anthony Bresnikan.
And we are your hosts. We are your hosts. This episode marks the beginning of a new era for the show, with Bresnikan filling the vacancy left by the late, great Scott Wampler as the new permanent co-host. And I can't think of a better guest to christen the KingCast 2.0 than Stephen King himself. So welcome back to the show, Steve.
Welcome, Steve.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Nice. Great to see you, Anthony. And it's always great to see you, Eric.
Oh, well.
What I was saying before is that the KingCast is a nice place to land. You know, mm-hmm. It casts a wide net and there's a lot going on there. And it's all something interesting.
Yeah. Well, especially this year. And we'll talk about that in very soon. Yeah. But this year is going to be a banner year for your stuff, man. I think there you have it, my count is you have about 47 adaptations hitting between TV and film. You got a new book. It's going to be a banner year for you, and we'll dive into that in a second.
This reminds me a little bit of you know that movie The Three Amigos, where Martin Short gives the inspiring speech about some people's El Guapo is poverty, some people's El Guapo is an inability to read, but our El Guapo is the actual El Guapo, and we have the actual El Guapo on the KingCast. So it's a great way to kick things off. Like you said, Steve, this is about your work, but also the ripple effects of your work and the people who are influenced by your work and the people who...
Well, it's been great. It's been great. And you know, the thing is, it's like I actually lived to see that happen, which is cool.
Yeah, so
I don't really understand it, and I don't think about it a lot, but, mm-hmm. You know, I don't get down on my knees at night and say, dear God, thank you for all the people I've influenced.
Well, I do because I wouldn't have a show without that. So thank you. So Scott had one burning question. Last time you came on the show, we had a whole list of stuff we wanted to talk to you about. And, you know, you gave us a whole lot of time, but this one just kind of fell off the list. And so in honor of Scott, I wanted to ask you this question. Doing a show like this, we'd look at a lot of your work and we noticed Korn plays into a ton of your writing. You know, you have Children of the Korn, obviously, but Korn is a big part of The Stand, Secret Window, Secret Garden. You even wrote a corn cob kill in your script for Sleepwalkers. Mm-hmm. So what is it about Korn that keeps finding its way into your work? Or as Scott would have put it, say, man, what's up with all that Korn stuff?
Yeah. Nebraska. That's the short answer. Nebraska. I love Nebraska. And it is like I've ever lived there. And I don't spend a lot of time there. But I've driven across it, car, motorcycle, both. That's where I was when I saw that thing from The Prince of Tides where he says, oh, mama, do it again. I saw the sun going down in the west and the full moon coming up in the east. And, you know, to me, it's some one of those guys from the 40s or 50s said, they asked, why do you write about Wisconsin or Nebraska or whatever it is? He said, because in middle America, reality is thinner. And and I feel that in Nebraska, particularly in the Sandhill country. So, yeah, I'm crazy about Nebraska. Nebraska means corn, although there's a lot of Nebraska in T3. And it's, you know, it's the part of Nebraska up north where it's turned into either biodiesel or some other diesel thing, you know. But right. Yeah, it's, in other words, it's not eating corn. It's gasoline corn.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's by T3. Are you talking about Talisman?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean that's another interesting thing, you know, that we were talking about how mm-hmm. you usually don't talk about what you're writing as you're writing it. Mm-hmm. And you know, you've gone out and been very public about how you're writing Talisman 3 now. Is yeah. there a reason why this one you just felt like sharing? Because that was pretty unprompted. You were just like, you know what, I'm going to share with the masses that I'm working on Talisman 3.
My grandfather used to say, Stephen, this is when I was a kid, he'd say, Stephen, when you open your mouth, all your guts fall out.
Right.
I talk about a lot of stuff. I get enthused by things, you know, I get whipped up.
Yeah.
And this book has been exciting to work on for a lot of reasons because, man, Peter's not here to work on the book with me. That bothers me the way that the loss of Scott Wampler, you know, bothers you. Nothing against you, Anthony, because mm-hmm. you're more than a fill-in. You're a great mm-hmm. guy and smart guy and all that. But, you know, Scott was a good guy and Peter was a really good guy. And I've been channeling him like a motherfucker while I'm working on Talisman 3. I find myself using his verbs. People don't necessarily walk into a room. They bustle into a room, because that's a very Straubian word. And I'm using as much of that as I can. And of course, the major thing is that, you know, I miss him. I kick myself for not working on it with him at the time. You know how it says, you always say, oh, there'll be time. And sometimes time runs out. And that was the case and with that. But man, I just, it's great to be back in the territories of Midworld. I mean, they're the same thing. By the end of Black House, it's pretty obvious that the territories are Midworld and Midworld is the territories. And it's just so great to be back there that I was bursting to say something. And my wife's heard it all before, yada, yada, yada. It's just Steve doing his shit. But,
do you talk to Tabby about what you're working on, or do you keep it to yourself while you're writing and then start talking?
No, I keep it to myself. If I have a mm-hmm. question, I'll ask her about flowers or plants or one of mm-hmm. the things that she knows about mushrooms. But most of the time, you know, I keep it to myself because it's like what Ben Mears says in Salem's Lot. You talk about a project, you piss it all out on the ground.
Right.
And I just, it's really a superstitious thing. I feel jinxed. So yeah, I'm careful about it.
Now the idea for Talisman 3, I remember a few years back, we did an interview and you said that Peter had an idea that he threw your way. Is that idea in this book? Is that the seed of it?
Yeah, it is. This was like in the early days of internet and the email and the chat rooms and the texting and all that. And he wrote me an email, which, like an idiot, I didn't save. But in my office, I can't find anything anywhere. You know, I've got notes everywhere, and here's some notes on the Glock 26 that I needed, YouTube videos and everything like that. So Peter sent me this thing, and he sent me a book that was called Redheaded Peckerwood. And it was about Charles Starkweather. And it's kind of like an artistic book. Starkweather was a guy who went on a rampage in 1958 and with his girlfriend, Carol Ann Fugate. And Peter wanted to use that in a certain way that I remember a little bit about. And it came clearer to me once I started to work on the book.
Right.
So he, that was just like a takeoff point, you know, Starkweather and Fugate. And he said a whole bunch of stuff, and I can't find the email. I don't know it. And so it's, I'm just sort of retrieving it from my ever declining memory.
You know, when you work closely, you know, and creatively collaborating with someone, and again, this is a loss that I felt, you know, personally, I found my, you know, that I'm in a weird spot where I don't want to try to recreate Scott's voice, but I also feel like a certain obligation too. So when you're actually co-writing a novel, you know, now you're writing this one without him, are you finding that you're trying to write in his voice a little bit, or are you just saying, no, fuck that, I'm just going to do straight up, you know, me as me?
It's both. It's like I said, you know, people don't walk into a room, they bustle if they're a certain kind of person. And there's an interest in clothes that Peter had that I don't necessarily have, and I try to honor that in a way. In other words, I'm trying to channel his voice as much as I can. And I'm a pretty good counterfeiter, you know. If I want to write like Lovecraft, I can write like Lovecraft. And, you know, if I wanted to write like Elmore Leonard, I could write like Elmore Leonard. There's a certain tics of style. But mostly what I'm doing is I'm taking a core idea that Peter had and trying to include the Dark Tower and the Talisman. It very much stands on the shoulders of the Talisman in Black House. So some of the characters from Black House are in it. Actually, some of the characters are in it from Talisman.
No, nice. Yeah, I know you kind of, you know, all the Dark Tower nerds out there, whenever you started tweeting about being, you know, towing with Midworld again, like everybody was just like, okay, we're going to get a whole new Dark Tower series. And I'm just like, hold your horses. Hold your horses. He's talking about Talisman. So, you know, I'm glad that, you know, I'm just happy that you're back in that world, man. It's like, you know, for the folks that love the Dark Tower, there's, you know, we're Tower addicts, man. We, you know, we want more of that world at any point, you know, whether it's, you know, through a little glimpse from another property or, you know, a direct Dark Tower story. So I'm psyched.
It's been exciting to be back, and it feels a lot like home. And I'm not, you know, any kind of a George R.R. Martin kind of guy or Robert Jordan. I don't do maps. I don't do geography, really. A lot of people would say Steve doesn't do fiction. You know, to be back is great. And to hear those, that mode of speaking again and behavior, and it's been good. Yeah.
Do you find that story concepts have a long shelf life for you? I know, you know, the cliche of the question for you is, where do you get your ideas? And from our previous conversations, it always seems like, you know, it's an amalgam of things. You'll think about Danny from The Shining, and you'll see a news report about a cat in a nursing home, and then like ideas begin to form together. You mentioned, you know, Peter proposing this Starkweather element as a possible continuance of Talisman 3. But I think also one of our reader questions recently was about the idea you had for Chrome, the John D. McDonald book that you were interested in writing. And I wondered, like, did you ever take the elements of the story you had in mind for that and use them in other things? Did Chrome find its way into your writing in other ways?
No, it didn't. I had a very clear idea. I've said that a lot of times, to me, a story is like this red thread that comes out of a mouse hole in the ground. I mean, it's a mysterious process, but if I have a clear scene in mind to start something, generally speaking, it follows. Whatever follows seems logical and right to me. So I had this idea about Travis McGee and his friend Meyer walking on a beach, and Meyer collapses, and Travis thinks he's had a heart attack, and there's a follow sound, a report, and he realizes someone has shot Meyer and killed him, actually, because it was going to be the last book. And from there, I thought I can do this. And I got in touch with the last surviving twig on the McDonald tree, which is on Maynard. And Maynard said, I would rather not carry on. So
the Talisman film adaptation has been rumored for 40 years now. I know Steven Spielberg bought those rights outright and he continues to own it. I think the latest is that the Duffer brothers from Stranger Things have said they're planning to do it. Have you gotten an update on that?
No, I don't know anything about, I don't think about the Talisman in terms, well, I don't think about anything in terms of movies. I've had that luxury, frankly, for 40 years, man, Spielberg talked about it, and the discussions with Spielberg's rabbi, so to speak, Sid Sheinberg, were very difficult, and they were very argumentative. I was drinking a lot then and doing a lot of dope. And he was very, very adamant that he was going to take care of Steven and not let Steven, like a child, take too much on his plate. And I thought, okay, we're talking about a grown-up man here, a creative person. Why don't you just sort of step aside and let us do our thing? And it just never worked out. Never worked out.
Yeah, it's fairly unusual that my understanding is the option process on your stuff is very quick now, even with, people that are super close with you. It's like, my theory is that you're like, well, goddamn it, Steven Spielberg has held on to the rights, for the Talisman for 40 years. I'm not letting that happen again. why you have... that you're a stickler for you get a year to make this thing a reality or not? Is that something that plays in for you?
I've never charged people outrageous amounts of money for anything that I wrote. I just sort of send it out there and you hope that something will grow. Right. I never expected The Monkey, for instance.
Right.
Sort of get made the way that it got made. It had been optioned and dropped a number of times over the years. And I think James Wan came along and said, do you want to do this as a movie? And it was actually done kind of a stealth production. It was, I think it was actually filmed before anybody really knew what was going on with it. And so I saw a cut boom. And all at once, out of the blue, it's like, oh, this thing actually happened. But there are a lot of them, like The Jaunt has been optioned many, many times and nobody's ever done it. And I could go on. I could name a lot of different projects, mostly from the short fiction, but from novels too, like Buick 8, that's been optioned a number of times. Other ones too.
Well, yeah, The Long Walk was one forever. I think Darabont had the rights for a long time and was really hoping to get that made, and now you find that's finally happening this year. I love, by the way, that Luke Skywalker is now becoming a staple in your adaptations, you know, because he's in The Long Walk. He's great in The Life of Chuck. He was in Sleepwalkers back in, you know, back when you and Mick made that.
He was,
So,
You guys hit it off at the Life of Chuck premiere, it looked like.
yeah, he's a nice guy. He's easy to talk to, and there's no, star time feeling at all. And he's a fan of my work. I'm a fan of his, and we kind of grew up together. It's been good.
That's right. This is an impressive year for you. I wanted to run before we go too much further. I wanted to run through some of the things. You have Never Flinch coming out. Eric and I both have the galley version of that. But you also have Holly coming out, I think, in pocketbook format, and You Like It Darker will be in trade paperback. You're working on Talisman 3. In terms of movie adaptations, you've got Mike Flanagan's The Life of Chuck, Francis Lawrence's The Long Walk. Andy Muschietti is going back into It country, Pennywise territory with Welcome to Derry, and Edgar Wright is directing the Running Man movie. You've got The Institute on MGM and Oz Perkins's The Monkey, which we've already talked about. And I think Kate Siegel is doing Lily as a YouTube short, which I think is Here There Be Tigers, a little adaptation of that. It feels like I know you said you don't get involved with the movies very much, but it must be satisfying to know that your stories resonate so much and that so many other creative people want to participate and play in your yard, play with your toys, so to speak.
Yeah, it's a nice thing, but it doesn't. I mean, for me, at the beginning, it was all about let's put some distance in between my family and the poorhouse. Okay. In other words, I went into this with my eyes wide open. I know that most writers who published, and there are very, very few who make a living wage from just the writing alone. And that's really what I wanted to do. And when Carrie came along, it helped the book. There was no money involved. If you listen to MGM or United Artists, whoever now owns the rights to Carrie, they'll say it never made a profit.
Yeah,
How's
that's
that
why they
possible?
remake it, you know, every 3 years.
Yeah, well, there's a creative accounting that goes on.
You're
Anyway,
right.
but I got a certain amount of money for the option, a little bit more from, although Doubleday at that time, those thieves took about half of it. But anyway, it sold the book. They could put a movie cover on the paperback, and at that time, paperbacks were the dog that wagged the tail instead of the tail that it doesn't wag the dog. So anyway, the paperback came, got a second wind, and it went to the bestseller list, and I was off and running, and I was happy and excited. At the beginning, I mean, when Salem's Lot got made, and then when Kubrick, decided that he was going to make the Shining, I was just over the moon. I mean, I was shaving one morning, and my wife comes in, and she's got this expression on her face, and I'm thinking, who died? And she says, Stanley Kubrick is on the phone to talk to you. And so I actually talked to Stanley Kubrick. What I'm saying is, at the beginning, all these things were really sort of exciting and new, the way that anything is when you start out. And over the years, I will say that I have never taken my good fortune for granted. I'm very, very grateful for everything that I've gotten. But as far as the movies go, I'm over here on the left side, and the movies are over here on the right side. Sometimes they get together. Sometimes I really like what I see. And when I like what I see, I say what I can see. I think Life of Chuck is fucking fantastic. I really do. Some of the other ones, I don't talk about them because, my mother said, you can fill it in the blanks. If you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all. And it's worked pretty well for me. So when the movies come along, it's nice. I mean, I'm interested to see what that guy, Francis, whatever his name is, has done.
Francis Lawrence.
Yeah. Francis Lawrence, what he's done with The Long Walk. I read Molnar's screenplay and I thought it was terrific. And I thought the way that I felt when I read the script for Shawshank Redemption, I thought, wow, this is great, but they'll never fucking make this. So I'm curious to see whether or not they put Molnar's screenplay on the screen. Mm-hmm. And if they did, Steve, I think it'll be interesting.
Steve, you just had a great moving thread about your time meeting David Lynch, and you had a nice tribute to him upon his passing. I guess you met him while you were working on Maximum Overdrive, and that was a case where you became actively involved in making movies. You directed that. That's a favorite film of Eric's. Eric, tell him about your print that you
own. Oh, yeah. I have a 35mm print of Maximum Overdrive. It's
get gorgeous. Out.
And I've screened it a few times. Wampler and I did a screening with Stephen Graham Jones. He came to Austin for a book signing. And so we did like an event where he came and we introduced the movie and watched it. And the crowd fucking loved it, Steve. Like I you know, I know that, you know, I'm sure that your thoughts on that are you know, are you, on that whole experience are mixed or whatever. But, you know, and some of the reception for the movie. But it plays still to this day, man. And it's so fun. I love that movie. So any chance for me to tell you that like you did good in the movie's holding up, I'm gonna take it. So
I went into it, and the thing is, at that time I was doing a lot of cocaine and I was drinking a lot.
You can tell with the movie for sure.
Yeah, I know you can tell. But the thing is, man, I thought I knew how to make movies, and I realized, if I did that again, I learned so much making Maximum Overdrive. It was like this intensive seminar. And, you know, I had this Italian film crew, the Nannuccis, and because I liked the work that they had done on Silver Bullet. And so I asked, you know, if I could have them. He said yes. And they didn't have any English. There was one. The younger Nannucci brother, Daniele Nannucci, had some English, and he did the best that he could. And the more he spent time on that set, the better his English got. And the only thing I learned was how to swear in Italian.
Vaffanculo.
So that takes me back to Dino, but that's another day. Anyway, Lynch was doing Blue Velvet while I was doing Maximum Overdrive. And Daniele could not explain something to me about why a shot wouldn't work. I had a certain way that I wanted to move the camera. Mm-hmm. And he'd say, no, Stephen, it crossed the line. It crossed the line. And so I couldn't really understand it. I got sort of a concept of it, you know, but not really. It wasn't like, you know, like a two shot with a master, you know, and you go over the shoulders and stuff. It was more complex than that. It was like, you know, the way you shoot a threesome is like freshman English. And this crossing the line is like a seminar. You know?
It's destabilizing for the viewer if the editing is jumping around in all directions. So, yeah.
Yeah,
it's one of those things.
I like that part in The Fablemans where Lynch plays
John Ford.
So John Ford, it is. You know, he talks about the horizon low is interesting. The horizon high is interesting. The horizon in the middle, shit.
Did Lynch help you understand that crossing the line editing thing?
That's,
or what?
That's the story, man. That's the story, Anthony. I ran into him one day after we had finished shooting, and I'd had this whole discussion with Daniele Nannucci about the way that I, you know, and his father was the DP on that show, and he was just crazy at the idea that I would even think about this. So I ran into David Lynch. He was leaving the Blue Velvet set, and I was finished shooting for the day. And I said, can I talk to you for a minute? And, you know, he's wearing his trademark white shirt and he had khaki pants on. He was smoking a cigarette. I was smoking a cigarette. And I said, what is this about the line? And he tried to explain about how if you have the camera on one side, you can shoot the other side. And if you have it there, you can shoot the other. And he said, no, that's not it. Okay. And then he said, but if you shoot like characters around a moving table, that's really confusing. And he said, I don't know, just shoot it your way. He didn't know it was either.
Listen, if I'm going to interrupt a chat with Stephen King himself, it better be important. And goddammit, what's more important than this week's sponsor, The Monkey, from the good folks at Neon? They've sponsored the entire show, so you're only going to be hearing about The Monkey this week. Once again, it's based on Stephen King's iconic short story, The Monkey, and has been brought to the screen by Osgood Perkins. You know him, you love him. He's the writer-director of Long Legs. He did The Black Coat's Daughter, Gretel and Hansel. He's the kind of weirdo we like here at the KingCast, and he worked alongside horror master James Wan. Stephen King himself described The Monkey as batshit insane and said you've never seen anything like it, and Bloody Disgusting calls it the most outrageous horror movie of the year. The Monkey opens in theaters everywhere on February 21st. And you've watched the trailers, right? They're fucking great. And they play with an audience. I've seen the trailer big. The audience is super into it. It looks bonkers. It looks insane. The only thing I don't really like about The Monkey is that Neon hasn't showed it to me yet. I know people have seen this movie, but guess what? I haven't, and I'm taking personal offense to it. I mean, what the hell, guys? I run the KingCast. I kind of need to see these things, right? Anyway, I can't wait to see it, but we're not too far off from release, so I guess I can try to be a little patient. It comes out in just a few short weeks. But speaking of trying your patience, how about we get back and finish out our conversation with the man, the myth, the legend, Mr. Stephen King.
Steve, speaking of your Hollywood adventures, Eric and I had a question about a photograph. It's sort of tangentially related to Spielberg, but do you see this? Can you explain what's the context of this picture?
I don't remember.
That's you with a gremlin. And
a gremlin on my head, but I think it might have been somebody might have sent me some gremlins in the mail because they send all kinds of weird shit. And I probably put it on my head for a goof and carried another one around.
We wondered if you were on the set of Gremlins or if that was something you visited.
No, I never was.
We had this other one where there's a gremlin in the background, some sort of office assistant.
Yeah.
But even you, it's a mystery even to Stephen King where the Stephen King gremlin picture comes from.
It absolutely is, but probably Joe snapped it and I was just, you know, playing Freddy fuck around.
Well, I have one more Maximum Overdrive question before we can move on from that. And that is, I understand why you made this choice because, you know, you're a huge rock fan. But what was it that made you go, okay, AC/DC needs to score this film? Because I love their score. I mean, I love it so much that, you know, don't tell them, you know, the KingCast intro's got AC/DC from Maximum Overdrive and, you know, in the background. Like, I'm a huge fan of that. Like when Queen would score movies, like I, you know, Daft Punk more recently, like I love it. Reznor and Ross now are, you know, making a living scoring stuff. I love pulling from that world. So can you tell me a little bit about the decision to bring AC/DC in to score your film?
I just loved their music, and I thought the idea of trucks out of control, and AC/DC has always seemed to be pretty much out of control, you know, that whole schoolboy thing with anger. And the music and the movie, to me, they kind of meshed. And so I asked them if they would do it, and they said that they would. And I actually was on vacation at the same place where they were mixing Who Made Who. You know, my wife and I had dinner with them, and they were really, you know, pretty nice guys. And Brian, the lead singer at that time, I remember him saying that Who Made Who was a difficult song for him, mate, because I actually have to sing. So, he called my wife a ginger. He said, I've always loved a ginger. My wife had red hair at that time. That's always held close to her heart.
Oh, that's
So
wonderful.
I just, man, they fit the movie, and in a way, that movie is like the original needle drop picture. And whatever was good about it, they made it better. And whatever was not good about it, they couldn't do anything about it anyway.
I love it. We need to get like one of these specialty labels to actually press like an LP or a collectible LP or something, because the score is not easy to find like by itself out there. So I don't know. But we need to get on that. I'll make that my project.
Okay.
Steve, we wanted to talk
Make it
about
so. Make it so.
there you go.
Done.
Steve, we wanted to talk about Never Flinch. It's coming up in May, and obviously 5 months ahead of time, we don't want to give away too much, but it features Holly Gibney as one of the major characters, but it's not strictly focused on her the way your previous book about her, Holly, was. She's really captured your imagination and keeps turning up again and again. What is it about Holly Gibney that you've found yourself drawn to?
I think that it's her insecurity, particularly social insecurity. I mean, she would almost be on the spectrum in some ways. She has got a little bit of OCD that I share, and that insecurity, I feel it. But with it is this incredible ability to detect, to understand, to pull deductions out of thin air almost. And to me, when she showed up in Mr. Mercedes, she was just supposed to be a walk-on character and kind of a dish rag kind of thing, and she had a chance to unlock some of her potential when she met with Jerome Robinson, Bill Hodges' friend. And I love that idea of her finding an outlet for all this stuff that was inside her, this ability to detect. And that added to the insecurity, made an interesting character. There's a thing in Never Flinch where she makes a deduction, and half of the deduction is right, and half of the deduction is wrong. And of course, she concentrates on what she got wrong, which is a thing that I think we all have a tendency to do. And I think that's one of the reasons why Holly has caught on with people who aren't necessarily in the horror suspense community, because she's got this quality about her, this doggedness. And so I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if Holly were a bodyguard for a women's advocate, a woman power advocate? So I did that, and that actually stayed in the books. I mean, when I did the first draft of this book, it was called something that I don't even remember. It'll come to me in a minute. But my wife read that book in manuscript, and she said, this really isn't very good. It's got it's derivative, and it feels like it's draining to make various connections within the story. And I took that very hard, but I also took it to heart, and I rewrote the book from the jump, a completely different version, incorporating some of the things from the original draft, which was called We Think Not. And then it was going to be Always Holly, and finally it became Never Flinch. So it went through these different iterations. And the thing was, in the first draft, I was greedy. I wanted actually three different plot strands. And the one that got lost, the one that got jettisoned, was I thought to myself, I would like to do something with finders keepers because they find lost dogs for a while. That's what they lived on. And I thought, now, wait a minute. Wasn't Lady Gaga's dogs stolen and the dog walker was shot or something like that? And I thought, that's perfect material. I want to add that to these other things. It was too much. It was too much.
No.
Well, but you do have two parallel stories. I don't want to give away too much, but there's a serial killer and there's a stalker, and this character you just described, this woman who's like a public speaker, like a public intellectual talking about women's rights that
Kate
Holly
McKinnon.
is protecting. So you do have a lot of threads that are still weaving together, and
But that's the almost like the fun of it, to see whether or not you can bring those things together in a way that doesn't seem like too eye rolling, you know,
Yeah.
like you're moving the characters around. I want it to seem like they're moving themselves around. They usually do, but when you do that kind of thing wrong, it always shows. And I swear to God, I will never write another plotted novel. Never.
But this one gets the Tabby seal of approval, obviously, or else it wouldn't have gone out. So,
No, she liked it.
okay, good.
She liked it.
How important is she in your work? I know if in many of your afterwords you've described her influence. I think the story about her rescuing Carrie from the trash bin is well known. I became really interested in researching that part of your life, the early years with you when I was writing about Carrie for Rich Chismar's Carrie 50th anniversary book. But tell me about, do you think you'd have a different career if not for Tabby's influence and her work as a sort of beta reader or editor, reading your stuff and offering her feedback?
I might have died of an OD at 38 or 39 without, you know, but the fact is that Tabby takes no shit from anybody, and least of all to me. So I get an honest opinion from her a lot of times, and she doesn't try to blow smoke. She'll say, "Oh, I like this. This is good," or she'll say, "You should fix this or you should fix that," and usually she's right. So, in other words, if she really likes it, she'll say, "Yeah, it's good." In other words, there are no superlatives involved. She doesn't have to be an agent or a book editor or something and fake something that they don't actually feel. She'll say, "Yeah, it was good," and then she'll tell me the things that she thinks are wrong. And sometimes I think they're wrong. Sometimes I think that I'll let it stand. So, you know.
One of the stories about you two from those early years that really moved me was, I think you were working as a school teacher and you guys were scraping by. She was working at the Dunkin' Donuts and you had two kids, and I think you were making like $6,000 a year at the school teaching job, and they offered you like $300 more to do the debate club, and she said, "But is that going to cut into your writing time?" And you said, "I think so." And she said, "Well, then you can't do it." And I found that even though you guys could have used that 300 bucks, that was a great piece of advice that she gave you, is to keep focused on the writing. That she doesn't just offer criticism, it seems like she's offered some important encouragement too at times when you might have made a different choice.
She
Has
was
that could.
serious, you know. She was always serious about the writing, and she understood that I was serious about the writing. That was one of the basis for, you know, our getting together. We understood each other, and like I say, she would give me zero shit, and it worked out well.
Does she still offer suggestions of things you should do or things you shouldn't
Oh,
do?
God, yes, of course. A lot of times she will just say, "Yeah, it was good," and let it go at that. And other times she'll give suggestions, and it's good.
Well, yeah, I know she's not as public facing as you are, But she, you know, you can let her know from us that she has a huge, like, the KingCast listeners fucking love Tabby. And like, and the guests that I have coming on, like, all the time, Kate Siegel, you get her on and she's like, all I want to do is like, she even pitched, Kate Siegel came in and is like, I want to pitch an episode where we just come on and talk about how awesome Tabby is. And I'm just like, I'm all for it. So I'm just need Kate to follow up on that. Let's do that.
Do it.
That'll be good.
That'll be
good. readers owe Tabby, a real debt of thanks for all of her work.
She's really quiet. She does not have a public persona at all. Yeah. And she hates all the celebrity shit. And that's a cute cat you got there.
Yeah. they're about to fight. So I was like, trying to break it up. I don't know if we want a cat fight in the middle of the KingCast. Yeah, this is my cat, George.
Oh, George. We have three of them.
Hey, George.
The listening audience, George is kind of a smoky color with a black head. And
yep, a little stray snowshoe that we rescued. Yeah. Steve, you know, speaking of celebrities, it's a nice segue. There is one little part, I don't think this is a spoiler, although it happens late in Never Flinch. You give a little shout out, speaking of needle drops, to Hey Steven by Taylor Swift. And I wondered if you were reacting to her appearance on Stephen Colbert's show where she said the song was written about you.
Sure. She was kidding and I'm kidding. But it was a shout out to Taylor Swift.
That's a nice little bit of a feedback loop, I think. A nice button to her her tribute, even though it was joking.
But you know what? It's not a bad song. She's a good artist.
I agree, and I remember when that aired, it was so funny because anytime somebody mentions Dark Tower in any sort of like real life setting, it like sets my spidey sense goes off, right? And the fact that even if it was a joke where she's like, the Dark Tower changed my life, I'm like, that's Taylor Swift. Her saying that means that there's probably, even if 1% of her fans were like, what's this Dark Tower business? Like, she's gonna fuck up somebody's day, and then but she's also gonna like make some new diehard fans. There was something else that recently was James Austin Johnson on the show a while back. You know, he does the Trump on SNL now. And he when we asked him to come on, he very specifically was like, I want to talk Dark Tower. And he had just gone to SNL at this point, and he was like, I am working every week to get a Dark Tower joke into SNL, some Dark Tower sketch. And I'll watch every week just to see if he got his Dark Tower sketch into SNL at some point.
Well, I think that they are kind of like those Dark Tower books are kind of and I read a bunch of them to get ready for E3 too, you know, the Talisman, the Black House, and a couple of the last Dark Tower books. And they're actually a smaller part of the audience. They're kind of like a rarity or a crudité or something like that. It's, you know, a different kind of beverage.
They're so unique. Like what I tell people is that, like, even if there are pieces of it you don't like, you're never going to read anything like it. Right. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, you take wild swings in those books, and that's the reason why it's, you know, the people that love it just love it. Cause again, there's nothing like it. And
that's what I like best about them. You've got a mad train with a personality and low mutants and everything in between.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember my first read of it. It was, you know, because I grew up on the Sergio Leone Westerns. My stepdad was super into those. And so he loved Bond and Clint Eastwood Westerns and that, you know, the very dad stuff. And when I started reading, because I'd read some of your work before, I'd read The Stand and It. I'd read all that, you know, all the classics, I think, before I got to Dark Tower. But I was still a kid when I was reading Dark Tower. I think I was in middle school when I started. And it was... it was the moment when Roland punches into the wall and comes out with a fucking jawbone where I was just like, okay, I think this is for me. you know, I think everybody has anything. I'm like, you can't really classify or, you know, exactly what that series is. You know, it's fantasy, it's Western, it's horror. It's, you know, it's everything. It's romance. You have a sweeping romance, you know, in the middle of it. Everything. It's like, You know, that's what I love it so much, and I'm dying for Flanagan's you know thing to come to
To take
fruition,
off.
because you know what, I've talked to Mike a lot about his plans on that stuff, and it's so good. I'm so happy.
I've seen screenplays and pitches, and he starts where he should start, and the beats are perfect. They're just perfect.
Well, that's Mike, man. Like, for whatever reason, like, he's just so clued in to knowing, you know, what your stuff is and how it translates. I mean, Life of Chuck is a perfect example. Anybody else looks at that story and goes, "No fucking way am I making a movie about that." You know, and if I am, I'm gonna come, like, I'll make it linear or I'll change whatever, and it completely, you know, changes what it means. And what Mike did is like, no, I mean, he did it with Gerald's Game too. It's like, this is a story that, you know, can't possibly work. Dr. Sleep, you know, he's gaining a reputation as the guy that, like, does the job that other people wouldn't do and does
He's
it well, you know?
the King Whisperer.
He is.
Do you have a favorite? Sorry, Eric.
No, please
I think you
go.
said that. Do you have a favorite pop culture reference to you or your work? You know, Eminem gave Salem's Lot a shout out in Lose Yourself, which is a really cool one. Is there, Eric and I were noting that in When Harry Met Sally, Billy Crystal is reading Misery in one of the scenes, which obviously was Rob Reiner had a connection to you through Stand By Me and The Body. But is there something out there that's ever caught you off guard? And, you know, like, they're reading your book, they're giving you a shout out,
You
or.
know, the only thing that I can think of, you know, that even comes close to the what I sense is the nugget of your question, which I'm not sure that I understand at all, is, and I found out that there was a pro hockey goalie named Curtis Joseph who called himself Cujo. And he wore a mask that had a dog face on it. And I thought, that's really resonant. That's sort of cool.
That's exactly what I was talking about, is just, you know, a reference to a book, or you as a writer turns up in a song, or in a, you
It's
know, guy like that putting it as his mask.
like a cultural oil spill, the way I've seeped into the culture.
You
Well,
know?
you know, it's funny you mentioned Cujo, because that pivots to, Eric and I had kind of a lightning round of little random questions we wanted to throw your way. And one I had is, I watched Gilda, the Rita Hayworth movie, the 1946 movie. And at one point, she gives her phone number to a man and she says, "Oh, my phone number is Cujo 3017." Obviously, you know that movie. That's a part of the Shawshank Redemption. Is that where the name Cujo comes from?
No,
No.
it came from one of the SLA guys called himself Cujo, the black guy, and you know, because it was a white gang with one black guy and Patty Hearst, and this guy's name, his street name or his slang name was Cujo, and I
Oh.
love that.
Thought that's a good name for this terrifying rabid creature.
Well, and something that I think is going to, you know, when you came on in the last time, you're like, you know, in 100 years, when I'm long gone, like, people will still remember Pennywise the clown. Like, he's like the fucking clown. People will remember, I think is how you put it. But, like, I'm thinking on it, I think Cujo is going to be the thing. Like, in 300 years, people are still going to be, like, ironically naming their Chihuahua Cujo. You know
A
what I mean?
chihuahua, so, and they won't remember where it came
They
from.
have no idea. I think it's just part of the lexicon now. So,
That's what I mean about the seeping
your oil
process.
spill. Yeah. Part of these, Brez, do you want to throw up the misery thing real quick
Oh,
as part
yeah.
of the lightning round?
Steve, this is one of the books I've had since I was a little kid, the paperback for Misery. And I've always wanted to, you can even tell how old it is based on the aging of the pages. But I was always curious about this Harlequin romance interior cover that has a very familiar looking gentleman as the paramour.
I thought it would be a howl if they did that, the sweet savage treatment, and put my face on the strong, studly guy.
Like Fabio's body, yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah,
so, I figured you modeled for the whole thing. That's not you? Cut
sure,
like
no, yeah. I don't think so, man. I don't think so. I wish. Okay.
So that's the story behind it? It was your idea? Let's do a Harlequin
that was my
cover?
Idea. Yeah. Let's do a double cover.
That's fun. Very fun.
I love it. I remember even as, you know, when reading that, like even I clocked that as, and you know, I don't, I think one of the things about your work that I love so much is that it, there's a lot of Easter eggs. You reward the reader for reading a lot of stuff because Alan Pangborn will show up in one book and then they'll show up in another. And, you know, like, and before Marvel made it all the craze to do the shared universe thing, you know, obviously Dark Tower is the centerpiece to all of that. But, you know, I don't know. I've always loved those little like nods, you know, even when, if it's as simple as you doing your little, what I call them, like fireside chats with Uncle Steve at the end, where you'll be like, here's where I was when I was writing this, here's what this means. And then you, you know, sign and date it. And it like you have a rapport directly with the reader that I don't know a lot of, at least can, you know, modern authors that do that. There's like a little playfulness, I guess, that I feel from your stuff. I don't know if it's intentional or if it's just, you know, that's what was fun in the moment for you, but that's how it's played out.
It just happens when it happens. Yeah.
Cool. Well, one of the things that we wanted to bring up is the concept of trunk novels. And I know that Lisi's story has, you know, that's a big centerpiece to that. And this is a question we get asked all the time is like,
Steve has trunk novels? Yeah.
And I'm just like, well, I know that the dude's prolific as all hell, but, you know, like I have no idea. So do you have trunk novels, you know, Steve? Is that?
I don't have trunk novels per se, but I've got a lot of unfinished short stories and even short stories that weren't very good. And they're all somewhere, but I don't know where.
Isn't that what happened with the, I believe in You Like It Darker, you made a note of like The Answer Man was one of those, right?
Yeah,
that was
The
found?
Answer Man was one that my nephew Jonathan found in a trunk.
Literal trunk story,
boxes in a trunk. And he found all these stories and most of them weren't very good. Some of them were, and that one just called to me and said, finish me. So I did. Yeah.
What were the five books in this book, the Bachman books? You mentioned that you wrote five novels before Carrie was published, and I was trying to figure out which ones those were. Was it The Running Man, Getting It On / Rage? I know The Long Walk was written when you were in college. What were the other?
There's one called Sword in the Darkness that was really not very good. Mm-hmm. It was an effort to write a long novel, you know, a multi-character shifting perspective kind of novel. And there was one called Blaze.
Blaze was written before Carrie?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow. I wasn't sure if you were counting The Aftermath. Wasn't that like a post-apocalyptic?
Oh, my God, The Aftermath. I don't know if you can call it a novel or not. I think it was like 56 pages long. it was written when I was like 14 or 15. It was not bad, but it was not good either.
Mm.
Yeah.
I am not much of a collector. The books that mean the most to me are the paperbacks that I save my money to buy at Kmart or, you know, the books that I was given by someone as a gift or a galley that I happened to read, whatever book I spend time with, that's the one that means something to me. But I, over the holidays, I splurged on something and I wonder if you recognize it.
Oh my God. That's like the first story I published or maybe the second one. It was called The Glass Floor.
The Glass Floor, Startling Mysteries, number 6.
Yeah, I got $5 for that story.
$5?
I think Bresnik can probably pay a little bit more than that for that.
Don't sell me short. It was 35, not 5.
Oh, okay.
Oh, 35. Oh, okay. What does this take you back to? I imagine that I remember having my first short story published in a little magazine when I was a teenager. It meant everything to me. And I wonder, you know, if you can tell us just the story of publishing that story and how you got the word and how you,
it was,
did you get,
It was, you said it. It's everything. You know, it was very, very exciting to get an acceptance letter after a lot of rejection letters, although I had gotten a letter before from Mr. Lowndes, who edited that magazine, you know, and he said, this is really a good story and this is the reason it's wrong and that's why, but send us more. And I was so excited by that. I mean, it was great to get $35 for a story and to actually have, you know, something to talk about. It was the beginning of a curriculum vitae, if you like, you know. So that was fantastic. And it was just very exciting. I remember I got copies in the summertime. I was living in a little town called Durham, Maine, and it was very exciting. Very exciting.
Yeah, I was going to say, what you probably spent all 35 of those dollars buying up copies to show people, like, look, I'm published.
What'd you do with the money? Do you remember?
No, I don't remember. Probably more postage.
to add up more rejection letters, yes.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, we've kept you for a bit. I have a few more questions, and then we'll let you go here. Before I dive into my craft question, Anthony, do you want to ask about the anniversary? Is that...
Well, yeah. You know, I'd messaged you, Steve. When you just had your 54th wedding anniversary, you and Tabby. And I know you've already talked about how important she was in your life. I was curious, how did you two celebrate that event?
I think we had some chocolate cake and we sat at the kitchen table and ate cake and we shared a couple of little cards and presents, but you know, it was a low key thing and it's not one of the big ones. So, but a good one.
Still a good one.
Well, 55, you're going to have to really blow it out, Steve. I'm, you know, it's going to fireworks. We're talking swans.
Yeah.
You know,
well, I love that story you've told about the wedding rings and turning your finger green.
Yeah.
And you what'd you say to Tabby? Like, I wonder if these are the kind of rings that'll turn our fingers green after a month.
We went to this jeweler and picked up two wedding rings. I still have mine. She lost hers down a drain somewhere along the way, but and I replaced it. But so we got two rings for $15.95, and on the bus back, because my car was broken down, I said to Tabby, "I hope these rings don't turn our fingers green." And she said, "I hope we can wear them long enough so that that becomes an issue."
Well, I think 54 years is a good indicator that they're okay.
Yeah,
your finger's not green, right, Steve? You're good?
No, still good.
Oh, never did.
Okay, good. My wrap-up question for you is a craft question, and it has, you know, again, doing a show like this, you know, and I'm revisiting stuff.
A craft question?
Yes. It might be a craft question. You can let me know at the end of it. Craft question.
Crap question. That's what I said.
Exactly. Well, there you go.
Go ahead.
You know, I'm going to wear this as a medal of honor, just like when you told Scott to get a life last time. Like, that was his most proud moment. He would tell that story to everybody. He loved it.
Knock yourself out. Go ahead.
So this has to do with your use of foreshadowing. So you do a lot in your writing where you'll be, Pet Sematary is a very big example of this, where you, like, way before Gage dies, you go to the reader, oh, and by the way, this family's never going to be happy again. It's like, you know, there, you have moments that, and I noticed that it happens very regularly, where you'll be like, you'll drop in a little hint of like, oh, and then things are going to get darker in about 30 pages. You know, you're not really saying that, but it's, you know, for the reader, you know, it's like you're jumping ahead and then continuing the story and we're a little bit ahead of you. My question on that is I'd love to hear about your usage of that as a storyteller and how it, you know, does it, I know you don't outline, so is this like more of a note to yourself that you like, oh, this is an idea in the moment where like I want to follow up on this and you just kind of leave it in as a little crumb for the reader? Or is it like fully intentional where at that moment when you write that foreshadowing thing, is it more of a, you know, now I'm doing this for a suspense reason or a story reason?
it's basically winding the clock, you know, and then setting it ticking. You're saying something is going to happen. And, you know, it's an instinctual thing. Sometimes you want to do that and sometimes you don't. There's a lot of shit going on just below the conscious level of my mind when I'm writing. And sometimes that seems like the right thing if I know what's ahead. But a lot of times things happen in my stories and books that surprise readers because they surprise me.
Hmm.
I didn't think that little boy was going to die at the end of Cujo.
Right.
But he did. Hmm. He did.
Much to Dee Wallace's chagrin, by the way, she hated that. I've talked to her about that like multiple times now, and she was just like, I'm insisted, because they were, I guess there was a point during the making of the movie where they were considering doing the book's ending, and she put her foot down. She's like, I'm not doing this movie if you kill the kid.
We had that discussion long before Dee Wallace came on the scene. We talked about that with the producers at the UM Plaza Hotel, and they said, what do you think about the ending of this book when the little boy dies? And I said, I think if you put that on the screen, audiences will lynch you.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, one of the things that happens in the book early on is that Cujo licks that boy. So he died horribly of rabies after the movie's over.
Oh. Stephen King's downbeat alternate ending to Cujo the movie. So the kid got rabies
3 months later.
It was better to die of dehydration. Yeah,
terrible.
This is great, you guys.
Thanks for indulging all of our random questions, and we appreciate just getting to see you and talk to you. And I know how busy you stay, so thank you again for making time.
Yeah, it means a lot that you set aside, you know, this chunk to talk with us.
Well, the bill will be in the mail.
I don't know if I can afford it, but I'll pay whatever you send.
Listen, you guys are great. Thanks a lot.
Many thanks to the man himself for returning to the show and kicking off this new era of the KingCast. I still am kind of calling this the KingCast 2.0 or the KingCast AD. I want to take a moment to also shout out my brand new co-host, Anthony Bresnikan, for doing such a bang-up job helping me guide this particular chat. In the future, I'll wrangle him in to do these outros with me, but since he's not here, I can pump him up a little bit and say he's been a delight to work with so far and is already kicking ass and taking names. This is also a good time to remind you that starting now, the KingCast is moving to a bi-monthly schedule, so you're getting a main feed episode every other week going forward. But if you're missing that glorious KingCast content, you can always sign up for the show's Patreon, which is patreon.com/thekingcast, where you'll get extra bonus episodes that you can only find there. So if you throw us a few extra bucks a month, we'll make it worth your while. Right now, you have over 4 years worth of episodes with me and Wampler, and going forward, you'll get brand new eps with me and Bresnikan, with a mixture of guests familiar and brand new. You'll also get access to the Discord, where you can join our little weird freak community over there and talk about fun King stuff, among other things. Again, that's patreon.com/thekingcast. So the next episode will be along February 12th, and while we haven't recorded it yet, I can safely say that if you're looking forward to the adaptation of The Monkey, well, you're going to want to tune into this. And thanks again, might as well throw a little extra thanks to this week's sponsor, Neon and The Monkey. Again, can't wait to see the movie. It looks crazy. I'm super into it, and I'm very excited to talk more about the movie. Let's just say it. We'll leave it there. We'll just leave that there. And what else? We want you to keep an eye out in the main feed for drops of the very rowdy actual play sideshow that Wampler and I did, along with the great Mallory O'Mara and Jacob Hall, called Shelbyville. It's us doing an RPG, a tabletop RPG, where we build up characters in a world that's inspired by King's work. And Mallory and Scott and I play weirdo New England kids who brush up against the supernatural with very familiar Stephen King flavors. It's wild fun and maybe even a little bit emotional, and previously only available to our patrons. I think the whole world deserves to be exposed to this ridiculousness, so keep an eye peeled for both seasons of Shelbyville to drop in their entirety in the main feed of the KingCast. I still haven't decided if I'm going to slow drip this for the newbies or if I'm going to drop it all at once. As Indiana Jones once said, I'm making it up as I go along. But you will be getting all those episodes of Shelbyville, and hopefully you will be as enamored with those characters as we ended up being. And I think that should be that. Welcome back to the show, folks. I'm really happy the KingCast is back in action, and I'm very excited for all the shenanigans we have in store for you going forward. Thanks for sticking with us, and we'll see you next time. Adios, folks. The KingCast is hosted by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Anthony Bresnikan. The show is produced by myself, as well as Abby Goel and Tara Ansley, and is distributed by the Fangoria Podcast Network. Daniel Danger is our art director, and the show was created by me, the late, great Scott Wampler.